Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 8th, 2014, and this is show number 474. I've been really busy this week. I thought when I retired, I'd just lazy around all the time, but that's sure not the case. I thought with the big announcements on Monday from WWDC, I thought we needed a new episode of the Mac Roundtable. So I wrestled up Katie Floyd, John F. Braun, Bart, and me together to record episode number 224, all about WWDC. It was a great discussion, and I learned a lot because there was so much new information. I paid attention constantly. I mean, I didn't do anything but watch it. And, well, we were in the live chat. A lot of people were having fun in there. But I missed a bunch, even as much as I was concentrating on that. So anyway, episode 224 is up over at macroundtable.com. And, of course, there's a link directly to it in the show notes. Then the SMR podcast guys were nice enough to have me come on and record with them about, well, WWDC. They figured they better have somebody who knows something about the Mac and iOS to be in there to balance things a little bit. And this was a different kind of show from the way the Mac Roundtable worked, because I needed to put it in context of where things have caught up to Android, maybe the behind Windows phone, or they're ahead in some other areas. So it was a really balanced show, I think, where we talked about where Apple had stolen from Android, and Android had stolen from Windows phone had stolen from Apple. You know, it was kind of a good discussion. We got a lot into the fact that we probably all need to just get over it of operating systems stealing for each other, companies stealing the stuff in the OSs, because it's all fun for us. Anyway, Rod, Chris, and Rob were pretty cool, and they even pretended to be interested as I talked about the advances in iOS and OS X. And of course, there's a link in the show notes to SMR Podcast episode 212 if you want to listen to that. But then next, I was on the Daily Tech News Show with Tom Merritt for episode 2249. That is always a blast. We had a great discussion about the battle for our sympathies going on between Verizon and Netflix. Check that out over at dailytechnewsshow.com. All right, you think I'm done? No! I also did two new screencasts for Don McAllister's Screencasts Online. This week he published my shows about a really cool application called Home Inventory from binaryformations.com. It runs on your Mac and lets you inventory your belongings, like for insurance purposes, for fire, flood, whatever, and other kinds of disasters. The iOS show was about two free companion apps, also from Binary Formations, that let you use your iPhone to scan barcodes to take pictures for easy entry into home inventory, and a mobile backup program that lets you put your entire inventory on your iPad or iPhone. If you want to watch these videos, you'll need to subscribe to Screencasts Online over at screencastsonline.com. I'll also alert you when the Screencasts Online monthly magazine comes out, too, because it'll be in there as well. That way, if you'd rather watch them there and get more content from Don and the other contributors, it's a pretty fun way to go. Yeah, that's all I did. Oh, and I think I gave a speech at a user group, too. Or is that this weekend? I don't know. One last week, one this coming week. In other news, we're giving Bart a week off this week so that Donald Burr can come in and explain to us what the big changes announced at WWDC mean to Apple's development environment. During the show, Apple announced an entirely new programming language called Swift. I'm sure you've heard of it, and I think you'll enjoy hearing what Donald has to say about it. But speaking of Bart, over the last, what has it been, 5, 6, 7 years that he's been contributing to the show, many people have asked me how they can support him for all he has presented to the No Silicast. Several times people have tried to take up a donation to get him to Macworld so everyone could meet him. Well, there's finally a way to contribute to him on a value-for-value model. He has started a Patreon account for his Let's Talk podcast series, Let's Talk Apple and Let's Talk Photography, both excellent shows. Patreon is this cool service where you pledge, like a patron of the arts, a certain amount of money per month or per show, and you can cap how much per month so the person running the show can't suddenly make, you know, 20 10-minute episodes and drain your bank account. You don't have to donate a lot of money. Even a dollar a show will go a long way if a lot of people enjoy his content. And I know you guys have been getting it for free all these years, so I'd really like to see a lot of you guys go over and push that Patreon button on Bart's website. His two shows are fantastic, but even if you don't listen to his shows over there, you've gotten gobs of awesomeness on Chip Chat Across the Pond from him, so go throw him a few bucks a month on Patreon for all of his efforts. His Patreon page is at patreon.com/LTPod. If you forget all that, you can always go over to his website at lets-talk.ie and push the Patreon button right from there. Last week, I started to answer Tammy's really mean question, what are your top 5 favorite apps? I say it's mean because it's so hard to choose only 5. As I said before, I chose to break this up into my top five iPad, iPhone, and OS X apps. This week, we're going to take a look at my top five iPhone apps. The explosion of the internet has increased our circle of friends to extend around the globe. You listen to the show, so you now know Alistair Jenks in New Zealand, Rose from Tasmania, Kirshen in Iowa, Don McAllister in England, Bart in Ireland, Nightwise in Belgium, Paul Shadwell in Switzerland, George from Tulsa, David Bogdan in Japan. I mean, you've met all of those people through the show. It's so easy to have friends around the world, but one problem remains, trying to figure out how to communicate with them in all these different time zones. Back on show number 219 in 2009, a gentleman named Alistair Jenks sent in to us what I'm pretty sure was supposed to be a serious explanation of how to keep track of time zones, but which is so complicated it makes me giggle in confusion when I listen to it. I remember us actually listening to it in the car. We were in Hawaii at the time when that episode came out, and my kids just thought it was the funniest thing ever. In my case, I have a terrible time with addition and subtraction. Well, calculus came easy to me, so I haven't got a chance of being able to follow his instructions. Enter one of my top five iPhone apps, TimeScroller from TimeScroller.com. This little app does more than most. It doesn't just show you what time it is now. It shows you what time it will be when you want to meet up with that person. So let's take a look at New Zealand, for example. Any old Cider app can tell you what time it is for Alistair right now, but I can use TimeScroller to figure out that if I, say, try to call him at 10 a.m. my time, it's 5 in the morning the next day for him. He might just not like that time, so I can keep scrolling till it becomes a decent hour for him. And TimeScroller actually has a way of showing little balls that turn from green to yellow to red to show you whether the person likes that time or not. And you can actually set what green, yellow, and red is by the person. So like Bart thinks 2 in the morning is a perfectly valid time to have a conversation, where most people might not pick that. TimeScroller also takes care of all of the daylight saving time nonsense, too. It's bad enough that the U.S. changed the dates at which they flip back and forth. So Bart and I are, we're 8 hours apart, then 7 for a few weeks, then 8 again, and then 7 again. Because New Zealand is below the equator and on the other side of the international dateline for us, sometimes we're 3 hours apart, sometimes 4 hours apart, and sometimes 5 hours apart. Oh, and like plus a day or minus a day, I can't even keep track. It's because they go into summer as we go into winter, so instead of toggling back and forth like it does with Bart, it actually moves by 2 hours instead of 1 hour. Luckily, I don't have to remember any of this, though, because TimeScroller does it all for me. Last week, Bart sent out a notice for his Let's Talk Apple podcast, and he sent the time out in BST. Well, I don't know what BST is. I gave him a hard time for it. I said, come on, even TimeScroller doesn't know what that is. But after badgering him, I got a crazy idea. I tapped the plus button in TimeScroller, and I simply typed BST. To my amazement, TimeScroller simply returned with the words British Summertime and told me what time it was right then. I scrolled till BST said the time Bart had suggested, and then I could easily see what time it would be where I live when it hit the time he asked for. TimeScroller is on my home screen, and if you have to deal with people in other time zones, you absolutely have to check it out. However, I'm going to give you a weird caveat. Don't rush out and spend your hard-earned $1 for this amazing app right now, because Terry Brett, the developer, has a new version in beta that does even more, so I'll give you a heads up when that one comes out officially. You go pay a buck now, pay a buck later if you want to, but you don't have to. This next one is about as niche-y as you could ever hope to get, but it fits my goal of apps that A, I use often, and B, make me happy. I was actually a senior in college when I got to use my first calculator. Before that, I had to use a slide rule. I know, that makes me sound like I'm 100 years old, right? Well, maybe I am. Anyway, back in the late 1970s, well, no, I guess it was early 1970s, my dad got an HP 35 calculator, and it was the most amazing thing. I believe it cost around $300, and he actually let me use it. The HP calculators for engineers and scientists use what's called reverse Polish notation. I should look up why that's called that. I suppose it's probably over in Wikipedia. In the simplest of calculations, RPN calculators work by entering two numbers, then followed by the operation between them. So instead of, say, 3 plus 5 equals, you enter 3, enter 5 plus. Now, I'm pretty sure anyone listening or reading along with this who hasn't used an RPN calculator, that sounds completely nutty. And for simple calculations like that, it might be nutty. But when you get a complex calculation with a lot of parentheses, it's actually significantly fewer characters to do it that way. If you start on an RPN calculator or use it for any extended period of time, normal calculators are very difficult to use. When Steve and I were in college, we invested in calculators of our own. I bought the HP 11C, but he thought he needed imaginary numbers on his. Personally, I never believed in imaginary numbers, so he got the HP 15C. My dad got the 11C as well, so when he passed away, I got it, so I actually have two HP 11Cs. Oh, that's another thing. They never wear out. Ever, ever, ever. I think it's poor business model on HP's part because I never bought a second calculator. So what does all this have to do with my top favorite apps? A company called RLM Tools has built iPhone emulators for the HP calculators we love. I bought the 11C Pro, Steve got the HP 15C Pro, and now we have the interface and the RPM goodness that we've loved so very long at our fingertips, even where we're away from our real calculators when we're sitting on our Macs. I know there's a bunch of RPN nerds out there who listen to the show, and I'm sure they'll appreciate that the 11C Pro calculator from RLM Tools made my top five iPhone app list. I'm a huge fan of the Fitbit fitness tracker because it has made a huge change in my health. I lost 10 pounds 2 years ago, and for the very first time in recorded history, I have managed to keep the weight off. While I did make some permanent dietary changes, competing with friends on the Fitbit app keeps me out walking and running and going to the gym. Tyson the Mailman always beats me, as does Bill Palmer, and surprisingly, newcomer Rod Simmons is actually kicking my butt right now. Bastian Wolf and Gazmez and I have been going back and forth in the rankings. Knowing that these guys are either on my heels or right ahead of me causes me to grab the dog leash and torture Tessa with 3 or 4 mile walks on days that I've already made her run on the beach. In fact, some days, like today, she wouldn't even go with me. That's how bad it's getting. It was funny, right as I was writing this up, I got a message on the Fitbit app from Bastian saying, "Dagnabbit, I had to get up and do another half hour on the treadmill because of you." So it really does work. The app on the iPhone is a particular favorite because I'll be doing my walk, I'll be exhausted and sweaty. Tessa actually keeps trying to lay down in the grass to rest, and the app will ding and say, "Only 3,000 more steps to your goal." I have one of two reactions to that. When I look at it, either I think, "Cool, I'm about a mile and a half from home, so I'm going to make it," or sometimes she says that right when I sit down exhausted at home and I curse her when she says it. Either way, the app and the Fitbit together keep me moving and keep me healthy. On the iPhone, I can easily see the leaderboard, tap on someone's name and say, "Hey, Dean, do you have the flu? Why are your steps so low?" He's always saying it's because he works from home, but sorry, Rod Simmons works from home and he's beating me. Anyway, that's why I love the Fitbit and the app for the iPhone from Fitbit.com. When I went through my top favorite iPad apps, I told you that I love Downcast for watching video shows. Oddly, I use a different podcatcher on the iPhone called Pocket Cast from ShiftJelly.com. It costs $4, by the way. I have to give credit to Terry Austin for telling us all about Pocket Cast back on show number 439. I was really happy with Downcast, but after hearing Terry rave about it, I switched and I'm loving it. A couple of things I really like that may or may not now be in Downcast. I haven't checked on them on Downcast lately, so don't quote me by saying I said it wasn't in there, but when I last used it, it wasn't. I really like being able to make playlists and not smart playlists. Some days I've got a lot of grout to clean, so I need at least one Mac Geek Gab, but that often turns into a power washing session, so I'm going to need a good long twit or something else where Leo gabs on and on to round it out. If I'm going for a run, I often like to listen to Wired.co.uk podcast, but it only goes for 30 minutes sometimes, so I don't want to stop and have to start over and go looking around like an idiot for another show to play, so I'll create a playlist with more shows for my run. Let's say I'm doing a long drive alone to San Diego. That's another playlist, but handpicked by me. I don't want like the top three unplayed or in order they were created because, you know, you get in different moods. You feel like a show or you don't. Pocket Cast works great for using that nice little these nice little intuitive gestures, too. I like how Pocket Cast also cleans up your shows when you're done listening, or you can have them cleaned up if you have too many unlistened to episodes, for example. I like having the artwork full screen so I can easily whack the screen to pause while I'm driving. I wish I had the backwards swipe 30-second that Downcast has. Now that I think about it, I don't know that I've ever tried. I wonder if it does. But that would be really cool for when I miss some stat macOS can spit out. I'm not going to go through every bit of Pocket Cast because Terry did such a great job. And of course, that's linked to there as well in the show notes. Pocket Cast is my audio podcatcher of choice. And Shift Jelly even has an Android version in the Google Play Store, too. And I've got a link to that in the show notes. Okay, let's face it. I'm getting old. Might have mentioned that earlier. Remember me in the slide rule? My close-up vision is not what it used to be. I got lucky and I didn't lose it at 40 like most people, but I'm 56 now and I have to wear reading glasses on top of my contacts, and the fidelity isn't anything to write home about, but it's pretty good now. Here's a typical problem to be solved. Let's say I'm having trouble with my internet service, so I've got the nice lady on the phone from my ISP, and she says, hey, read me off the MAC address from that sticker on the bottom of your modem. My answer, when this actually happened, was, lady, I can tell there's a sticker, but if you think I'm going to be able to read that, I'm either going to have to get a magnifying glass or a teenager to see if there's a number on that sticker. If you're under 40, you're mocking me right now. If you're over 40, you're shaking your head in sympathy. You will all get here. Anyway, my solution to this problem is an app called Lumen from Bits on the Go. Lumen does one thing and does it well, as Tim Verporten would say. It's technically, I would say you would have to call it a camera app, but it starts zoomed way in. You point the phone at this supposed MAC address, for example, and it will be huge on screen when you start. Tap on the lock symbol, and Lumen waits until you stop jiggling and locks in the image. From there, you can pinch and zoom even more on the image to get exactly what you need to see nice and big. You can enable the flash if that helps as well. Lumen will even save these images if you like. You can also just tap the lock to unlock the image and it's ready to take another photo. Steve and I used Lumen just recently to figure out what model watch his father had because I wanted to buy one just like it. Here's another great use for Lumen. You're working on your AV receiver and you can't see the back of it to tell which HDMI port you want to plug into. Turn on Lumen, tell it to flip to the front-facing camera. Now hold the iPhone facing you but behind the receiver. You'll be able to see what it's seeing like a mirror, but you can also take a quick, well-focused shot so you can read the teeny hidden labels above the ports on the back. Heck, sometimes I just use Lumen to read a menu in a restaurant. And yes, my children mock me for this and offer to order me some mashed potatoes with some nice peas in them. I know you're saying that the iPhone's regular camera app can do all of this, but it doesn't seem to work as well as Lumen. I think it's because Lumen starts zoomed way in, and yes, I know it's a digital zoom, and it does a much better job of waiting for a still shot to get a super sharp image. If you're an old fogey like me, check out Lumen in the App Store. By the way, it's L-U-M-I-N in the iOS App Store. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the top five iPhone apps. Next week, I'll take on my top five Mac apps. Maybe if I have too many, I'll split them into menu bar apps and regular apps just to make Tammy crazy.
Hello, fellow Nercella castaways. Alistair here again from New Zealand with perhaps a surprising answer to a common question. The problem to be solved? Numerous times in the last few years, I have heard podcasters addressing the question, what software should I use instead of Photoshop? The usual answers include the GIMP, Acorn, and Pixelmator. Certainly all three of these apps are powerful and functional for many purposes. The GIMP in particular is aimed squarely at taking on Photoshop, although it lacks some finesse in the interface, being open source and cross-platform. Acorn has been improving in leaps and bounds, as has Pixelmator, which recently added yet another Photoshop-inspired feature with layer styles. Both of these have great interfaces. All three of the apps I have mentioned address the typical use case of Photoshop, general graphics processing. If you're simply looking to fix your photo exposure, maybe do a crop and clone out some dust specks, then iPhoto, Aperture, or perhaps Adobe Lightroom are frequent and great suggestions. But I have one more suggestion which you may not have thought of. If you're thinking you need something Photoshop-like, how about Photoshop? The primary, perhaps only, reason the question arises is the high cost of Photoshop. Everyone seems to think of it as both the best of breed and the most expensive, but it doesn't have to be. Right now, Adobe have a limited time offer. I can't tell you when it runs out, but I took advantage of it as soon as it appeared, and it's still available 6 months later. So it's not fleeting. Still, if you're interested, it's best you get along there soonest in case it's about to go away. The deal is called the Photoshop Photography Program and costs only $9.99 per month if you commit to a year of membership. Yes, it's one of those Creative Cloud subscription things. Now I bet the first thing you're going to think is, wait a minute, $10 a month for a year? That's $120 for just 1 year. Or perhaps if you're an engineer, you'll at least admit it's only $119.88. Sounds expensive, right? Well, yes and no. Have you ever stopped before buying your daily cup of coffee and thought, hey, a coffee a day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year? Holy cow, that's $500 for coffee, and I don't even have anything left at the end of the year. Yeah, I didn't think so. What about your favourite alcoholic drink, or cigarettes, or chocolate bars? Still think it's expensive? Did I mention that for your money you also get to use Lightroom? I used to be a Lightroom user until I made the decision to switch to Aperture. If the act of switching, in either direction, wasn't such a tear, I'd have no issues going back to Lightroom. To quote my brother, amateur photographer and professional Photoshop user, Lightroom is one seriously sorted piece of software. Oh, and you'll also get 20 gigabytes of cloud storage and a Behance ProSite thrown in, a photo portfolio offering from Adobe. You'll also get all software updates for free, much like with Apple. The software does phone home to check on your subscription, but only does so once a month, and it has been flawless for me. And although you have to commit to a year, Adobe bill you monthly, so there's no big initial outlay. Have you ever looked for Pixelmator tutorials and resources? They're out there, and there are some great ones. I'm sure there are Acorn ones too. Want a Photoshop tutorial? Okay, there's one downside. You'll have to hunt for the best out of thousands and thousands of them. Or join one of the many communities that have grown around this genre-defining piece of software. There's even a pretty good chance you know someone who has Photoshop skills. This software has been maturing for over 20 years and has become an industry-standard tool in visual arts. You know how you've been trying to find the best software that measures up to Photoshop? Well, hey, Photoshop measures up really well on that scale. Perfect score.
Well, that's actually really interesting, Alistair. That's an interesting way to look at it, is why are we trying so hard to use these alternatives when maybe the correct tool is the tool we're trying to avoid? I have to say, though, I still think that the gift that keeps on giving, having to pay month after month after month, is getting kind of hard. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's draining our bank accounts. You know, remember when TV used to be free and now we're spending, what, $100 a month or whatever to get, because we got to have HBO, we got to have Showtime, we got to have all this stuff. So I don't like the monthly things. I like to buy something and pay for it once and get the joy at the front. I'm also a fan of Photoshop Elements, which is another way of getting the Photoshop goodness, but for a lot less money. But you do make some compelling points for the entire product suite.
Greetings, fellow Nozilla castaways. Kershen Sia from freerangecoder.com here with a review. It's about camera-related accessories this time. First off, let's look at the problem to be solved. You have a nice camera, be it compact or digital SLR, and don't quite like the idea of hanging the camera with the included neck strap. Most of these are thin and can cause quite a bit of pressure on the back of your neck. And then there's the extra time you need to look down for the camera, wrap your right hand around the grip, whisk it up to eye level, and take the shot. Wouldn't it be perfect if the camera sat ready close to your hand? Well, there's an accessory for that. I first read about the ProStrap camera wrist strap on the Gadgeteer blog and decided to purchase the deluxe belt strap for my Olympus C7070 camera. The thin nylon loop of the strap threads onto the metal bracket on the camera's body and attaches to a buckle on the leather wrist loop. To use the strap, you put the leather loop on your wrist and adjust the metal slider to cinch it as tight as you like, and voila, the camera is securely attached to your wrist. Now you can quickly swing the camera around, grab the hand grip, and take the picture. And the best part is that the camera is safely attached to a part of your body. ProStrap also makes wrist straps in a number of different styles, so for my Nikon DSLR, I opted for the two-point grip strap. This particular model has two nylon straps attached to buckles on the outside of a leather pad. One of these nylon straps goes to a metal loop on an oval piece of leather with a 1/4-inch tripod screw, while the other has a loop which attaches to the metal bracket on the camera. You screw the tripod mount part onto the camera and attach the other nylon strap through the camera's bracket. Cinch the straps, and now you have a leather strap which you slip your right hand through to hold the hand grip. I usually carry the camera by supporting it with the back of my hand through the strap and simply tighten my hand on the camera's hand grip and swing the camera up to my eye. Don't worry about not being able to use the tripod mount on your camera, as the bottom part of the strap has a large knurled knob ready threaded for a tripod. How neat is that? And the large knob makes it really easy to tighten the base to the bottom of the camera. ProStrap makes a number of different wrist straps in a variety of colors, so go check out their website and find the one which works for you. And if you really need one, they even have a neck strap as well. If you happen to have a camera which needs a split ring for an eyelet camera strap mount, they carry those too. The deluxe belt strap currently retails for $14.99, while the 2-point grip strap sells for $19.99, all available on ProStrap's website. I've included links to the items reviewed and pictures of my setup on the Olympus and Nikon cameras. Eagle-eyed folks might notice that I'm not using the bottom piece of my 2-point grip strap, but instead have a strange-looking adapter plate. This is the camera plate portion of the Peak Design capture camera clip, but hey, as they say, that's a topic for the next time. Well, that's all for now. It's Kirshan Sia from freerangecoder.com, and I'll see you in the Bitstream.
Well, Kirshan, I love this because I did go out and get a strap similar to what you're talking about, the wrist strap, and I love it. You know, I've bought other straps. I bought the diagonal one, goes across your chest, that kind of thing, and the one I just keep on my camera is that one that just grabs at my hand because I can walk with it. I can just have it in my hand all the time, and you don't have the strain of squeezing your hand to hold your camera because you can relax, and it's tight enough on your hand that it doesn't fall off. You know, if you're swinging your hand around, you naturally sort of grip it. So those things work really well. So that's a fantastic recommendation. Love it, love it, love it. Well, this week I was helping a buddy of mine with some audio problems with his new podcast. He was doing some pretty complex shenanigans that could have been done much more simply. One thing I wanted to show him was how to use iTunes to transcode his uncompressed audio files into MP3s and at the same time throw in the ID3 tags that tell podcatchers about the show, you know, things like who created it, whether it's clean, and the album artwork. I had him on Skype where he was screen sharing to me, and as I showed him the different steps, like how to set it to be a mono file with the right bitrate, I noticed he was taking screenshots. When we were all done, I told him, you could toss all those screenshots, because I just emailed him a clarified document with all of the steps I showed him. All right, technically it was created in the old ScreenSteps desktop, but today I would have done it and clarify. But the cool thing is that document I created for the Podcasting on Podcasting series so many years ago was still useful, and I didn't have to recreate a thing to send it over to him. I can't recommend Clarify from clarify-it.com enough for helping yourself, your friends, your family, and your coworkers to learn how to do something and to not bug you to explain it to them the second time. Check out the free beta and go have some fun. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And this week we have Donald Burr on, who preempted Bart because he just couldn't stand to not come on and talk about the geekier aspects of all the announcements at WWDC. How you doing, Donald?
I'm feeling like a kid in a candy store.
So Donald, if you haven't heard him before, is the host of the Otaku No podcast and has been a frequent contributor to the show. And like he said there, he's pretty geeky guy and going to kind of dig into some of the geekier stuff. On the Mac Roundtable, like I mentioned in the intro, we did go over, you know, more of an overview kind of view of it, but this is going to be digging a little deeper dive.
Indeed.
So where do you want to start, Donald?
Well, I just want to start out by saying I've actually been traveling all week, so with rather limited bandwidth, as you might imagine. And I was able to stream the keynote. I blew through most of my iPad's monthly data plan doing so.
Well worth
and,
it.
Yes, well worth it. And, you know, I was able to read the public blogs. I have not read any of the, you know, non-public stuff from the developer site, so I'm not. I'm only talking about, you know, stuff that I've seen publicly posted, so I'm not filing
NDA.
Exactly. Yes.
By the way, for people who don't know what NDA stands for, what does it stand for?
A non-disclosure agreement. Basically, when you sign up for the developer program, you say, you know, don't talk about this. You know, the first rule about Fight Club is don't talk about Fight Club. and of course, not everybody listens to that, which is why you see stuff on like Mac Rumors and whatnot. But, you know, whatever.
Right. But hey, they're the ones who disclosed it, not you.
Exactly.
So this was a big deal, right? And it was, this is just from a security standpoint.
Mm-hmm. This is huge. I mean, this keynote, I think it's not an exaggeration to say that this is the most significant keynote since the introduction of the iPhone itself.
For WWDC, I was listening to the Debug podcast, and one of the guys on there, they didn't introduce anybody, so I don't know who anybody's name was. One of the guys used to work for Apple and used to be the one who ran WWDC. He said, mm-hmm. This is the biggest WWDC keynote there's ever been.
Yeah, and I'd say this is the biggest keynote period, because what we're starting to see here is, yes, a ton of cool stuff got announced, but more importantly, Apple started to change some of its paradigms, some of its fundamental principles. And like I said before, I felt like a kid in a candy store throughout the whole thing, not just because as a developer I get to play with all these cool technologies, but as a user, apps are just going to get awesomer.
Because?
Because the one thing that really hit me this keynote is that we're starting to see Apple do something that we would have never thought that they would, allow us more access into the walled garden.
Now, they made a big point of pointing out how they did that, though, that they didn't make it the cesspool of...
Exactly. Android. Yeah, was it? I love it. Was it the hellfire? Or I forget what the yeah. It was a funny quote.
Obnoxious.
It was a funny quote, but yeah. And this is kind of like a fundamental difference in the way iOS does things versus the way Android does things. Android is like, here... You can do whatever you want. There's no walled garden. iOS, you know, instead, what the iOS guys did is, you know, they didn't just tear down the walls and give us unfettered access. What they did is they took the time to study the problem and think up a solution that would give people most of what they wanted, but without compromising their ideals, you know, security, protecting battery life, et cetera, and so on. So
how did they do that?
The thing that I really am excited about is extensions. And right. This is the way that apps can sort of offer their functionality to other apps. And Apple just, you know, they studied the problem. You know, they said, well, what do users mean when they say, I want to be able to access functionality from other apps? And so they figured, okay, what are the common use cases? Safari extensions, you know, to be able to, translate a web page or to, like, you know, fill in your username and password, like from one password or whatnot. Share providers, you know, when you know, the little box with the arrow pointing out of it, you tap that to share to Twitter or whatnot. Well, you can now add your own stuff to there. Third-party keyboards. This is a big one that, like, a lot of people have been clamoring for. And finally, today screen widgets. You know, when you pull down the notification center, you get your today screen. Well, now you can add little widgets to that. The way they did all this is really ingenious. Instead of having one app be able to directly inject its code into another app and thus gain complete control of it, instead, they're saying, okay, let's set up this middleman. It's an interesting technology called XPC. It started out in OS X, and they brought it over to iOS a couple of versions ago. And basically, it's like a kind of a buffer or a gatekeeper between, you know, the app that you're using and the app whose functionality that you're, you know, trying to access.
I'm trying to come up with an analogy in the physical world. Would this make sense that I could give you a key to my house, but that key only gets you into the foyer where I've got, you know, the casserole I wanted to give you or something. You know, I've got some thing I want to give you, but I'm only letting you into that front door.
Yeah, and there's an armed guard posted there to make sure that you only do what you want, you allow them to do.
Okay.
It's really cool, and the user is always in control. For example,
is that a good thing?
It is a good thing.
We're stupid. You should be in control.
Well, okay, let's compare this to the way Android does things. The way Android does things is they use a system called Intents, where basically you can advertise to the system that I can satisfy this certain intent, for example, opening a URL or opening a certain type of document.
Okay.
And when another app, you know, let's say I'm launching Google Chrome and I tap on a URL, the way it does it is it says, it asks the system, hey, who can satisfy my request to open this URL? Okay. And so this is very flexible and powerful, but it also is really confusing. Have you ever, on an Android device, sometimes like you tap something, you get this dialog box that pops up and says, what application do you want to handle this? And you have like a list of 20 applications. It's nuts.
I have seen that. Yeah.
It is absolutely
and I just kind
nuts.
Of get paralyzed because there's too many choices.
Exactly. Yeah. But the nice thing about the way Apple did it is, you know, you're always in control. There's an option, like for example, in the Today screen, which it's if you scroll down, you'll see a little edit button. Tap on it, and you can say, okay, do not put this widget on the screen. Or, for example, in the sharing button, you know, when you tap the share button, you see Twitter, Facebook, and then you know whatever other apps that you have installed that allow you to share. There's actually an edit button there. You tap it, and you can say, you can turn off. Like let's say you have.
Say you hate Facebook.
Yes, exactly. And
just off the top of my head.
Yeah, and what's even cooler is you can even change the order in which the items appear in the share menu.
So if I hated Facebook, you're saying the edit button would allow me to get rid of Facebook as an option?
You can either turn it off, completely get rid of it as an option, or you know if it's something that you think you might want sometimes, you could like move it to the bottom of the list so that you know the ones that you use more frequently appear at the top always.
Okay.
They really thought of the user, you know, when they architected this.
So I'm afraid we're making it sound bad that Android offers you a lot of choice. I mean, that's not a bad thing, but if it's confusing, it can be more difficult to use. That's all
exactly.
We're saying, right?
That's exactly what I'm saying. You know,
it's not less secure or anything like that in that instance.
Mm-hmm. So, and you know, I'm just really excited at seeing how developers are going to use this. For example, you know, obviously Safari extensions, you know, 1Password, you know, that like eliminates one of the major annoyances of using 1Password.
Now, I've heard a lot of people say 1Password, and I'm always really careful to say 1Password/LastPass. Is there
yes.
a reason you're not
sorry.
Saying LastPass?
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure there wasn't something about LastPass can't do
anything 1Password
could do there.
No.
Whether they choose to might be a question.
Yeah. And as far as third-party keyboards, you know, your first thought of, you know, Swift key, swipe, you know, that's the one that all people think about. But I thought of one developer that could use this. Text Expander.
Yeah, we talked about that on the Mac Roundtable, that could be exciting.
A Text Expander keyboard, you know, it would just work just like your usual keyboard, but then if you type in a snippet, it'll expand it. I thought, I'm just looking forward to what they're going to take this and run with it.
Yeah, that should be interesting. So talk to me more about the security model of that.
So, you know, it's
because you were saying that the way it's advertised in Android is different than the way they're going to do it in OS X.
Yeah.
Well, actually, let me back off the security for a second. One of the pieces I don't understand is, let's say 1Password wants to be able to be extended. Let's not talk in the keyboard side, but let's say they want an extension or you know any app, a camera app. How do they just build that door that people are allowed to come in, and then other people have to write to that hook?
Well, the way it works is, you know, you let's say I'm building an app for a photo sharing service like Flickr or whatnot. I can say, I can tell the system, okay, I'm going to allow sharing of photos as well as text captions. I don't accept videos because my service doesn't deal in videos. You know, if you send me photos and or text, you know, like a caption for the photo, I'll take it. On the other side of the equation, you have a camera app, and
right.
you know one of the camera app's functions is to be able to share. So the camera app says to the system, okay, I've got my user has this photo he wants to share. He has a little text caption that he wants to share with it. who can provide that service. So the system says, okay, it goes through its list of available services and says, okay, this app can accept photos and text.
So those two vendors from those two different apps don't have to have some sort of agreement and write APIs to each other like they used to.
Precisely.
They just it's simply just advertise, I can do this, and other apps are going, who can do this?
Exactly.
Oh, and that makes a lot of sense.
It does. They really study this problem for a long time. You know, this is classic Apple. You know, they don't jump on the bandwagon right away and do something. They think about it, they research it, they play with it, and they figure out a way to, you know, that they can do this without compromising their ideals.
Okay.
It's really slick. And like I said before, you have complete control of what apps show up. You know, you can turn off, you know, if you let's say you install the Flickr app and you use it to browse other people's photos, but you never you'll never want to use it to actually share stuff. Well, you can turn off their share functionality in Flickr so that it just doesn't appear, or you can move it to the bottom of the list if it's something that you think you might want to use sometimes. But
where in reality you just love Facebook and you always want to share there, that's the one you would have it default to,
right?
Or higher on the list anyway.
Right. Okay. It's just really cool. You know, one thing they said they're talking in the keynote that really struck me is, you know, when they were talking about third-party keyboards, he said, Federighi, I think it was who was presenting that, said, you know, we do not want the keyboard provider to be able to, you know, steal your data, basically. You know, we're really concerned about security. Mm-hmm. But if you want it, like, let's say that there's a keyboard app that, I don't know, sends what you're typing out to the network so that it'll, like, does like a, you know, word completion or something. Let's say that there's an app that does that. It'll actually say, hey, do you want to give, you know, keyboard app access to the network? And it says, because, you know, it actually shows that the developer can actually put up a reason for that, you know, saying, I'm going to use this data to do word completion or whatever. This is sort of in stark contrast to Android security model. You know, Android does have some security controls, but it's basically an all or nothing affair. When you install an Android app, it says, you know, this app requires the following permissions, blah, 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 this long list of permissions. And it's like, you either agree to all of them or you agree to none of them.
Sort of like whenever you try to connect to Facebook, it says, so this app is going to be allowed to do anything you can do on Facebook. Is that all right?
Yeah.
No.
It's like, no.
I have a point, though, that I'm surprised nobody else is bringing up. This whole thing that Apple does stuff on board to protect your privacy and isn't sending everything to the cloud. The voice recognition stuff only, like the voice transcription only mm-hmm. works if you have an internet connection, where on Android you can do it without being connected to the network.
Yeah, that's the one thing that's still kind of irritating me.
Yeah.
Although starting in OS X Mavericks added that feature.
Yeah, that you could have it locally.
You can have it locally. So, you know.
But iOS, you have to be connected to the internet for it to work.
Right. But I'm thinking that maybe they're working on that. You know, maybe it needs even more processor. You know, maybe we'll see that. Maybe we'll see that functionality when the A8 processor comes around, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, you can tell that it's on their. You can tell that it's on their mind.
To be fair, my, 2-3-year-old first version Nexus 7 could do it locally, so it's not because it needs an A8.
Obviously they're thinking about it because they added that functionality to Mavericks, so.
Yeah, but we got to give credit where credit's due. Android's ahead on that one.
I agree.
Okay, all right.
Anyway, so in Android security, it's like you install an app, you have to either agree to everything it asks for or you can install the app. With iOS, does it in a much more fine-grained manner. You can install, you know, let's say you install the Path app. You know, you can post and read other people's posts to your heart's content. But now let's say you use the functionality, you know, Find My Friends. Then it says Path would like to access your contacts so that you can use them to search for your friends who are already on Path. Do you want to allow this or not? And you can individually say, yeah, that's fine, or no. Likewise, you know, if you post something and, you know, you want to share your location, it'll say, you know, Path wants access to your location. oh, yes, is that okay or not? So you can individually say, yeah, this app, I'm okay with them using my contact data to search for friends, but I'm not so keen about giving them my location. It's really, and all of this, you can go into the settings and the privacy, and you can, you know, tweak all these individual settings to your heart's content. I'm really excited about all this, and I'm excited, you know, as a developer to start using these technologies, and I'm excited as a user to see, you know, what other developers, you know, how they take this ball and run with it.
Yeah. Now, you had something in show notes here about iCloud Drive. What's exciting about iCloud Drive for you?
For me, it's exciting because it eliminates the major annoyance that I have with iCloud, in that, you know, each app, its data sort of lives in its own little container. Like, let's say you want to edit on the Mac, you know, in Markdown. On the Mac, I use a Markdown editor called Markdown Pro because I prefer that editor because it has a live preview. You know, you can actually see a live preview as you type your Markdown. But then I want to edit on the iOS, my Markdown editor of choice is Byword, but I can't access the file that I saved in Markdown Pro because it's stuck in Markdown Pro's container. But with iCloud Drive, they're taking iCloud and turning it into more of a Dropbox-like thing. In that now, when you tap, you know, it's in an app, when you tap the open file button, it'll actually show your iCloud folder structure, so you can actually go in and
I would be happy just to be able to see the iCloud folder structure.
I know
it's in there, but it's buried down in your library. And I mentioned this on the Mac Roundtable talking to Katie. She
Is a way you can see your iCloud folder structure right now, but it's sort of a hack.
Right. But Katie came out with another way. Was they were talking about when what are they called, labels or whatever, tags came out in OS X. She said, well, just whenever you create a file in Numbers or Keynote or whatever, she said, just tag it with iCloud, and then you can create a smart folder called iCloud.
Yeah. No, but in both Mavericks, or sorry, not Mavericks, in both Yosemite, great name, by the way, and iOS 8, they're bringing that functionality, you know, front and center. And the way they're doing this also is really nice from a security standpoint. So, you know, let's say I'm in an app and I tap a file open and I browse, you know, in my iCloud to, let's say, that Markdown file that I was editing earlier. The way the system does this in the background is, you know, it doesn't give your app access to your entire iCloud partition. It basically does this cool thing using symbolic links where it basically only allows access to that one file that you specifically asked for. So, you know, let's say you were using a naughty app that wanted to try and do naughty things. The worst that it could do is mess up that one particular file you're editing. It can't access, break out and access the rest of your iCloud files.
Yeah, that sounds like it's going to be good. I just... You know, that's a little thing in the back of my brain. Are they going to do it right? Or are they going to be dumb? You know, are they going to make some bonehead move that, like, they burned us so many times. I feel like Lucy with a football, you know? Well, yeah. No, I feel like Charlie Brown with Lucy having a football.
Yeah. That is, you know, that's left to be seen. You know, there have been, frustrations with iCloud. You know, most notably, you know, Omni said, okay, forget this. We're going to create our own Omni Sync service. But it's gotten a lot better, and I think they're really trying to make it, make it so that developers can come back to it. So, you know, we will see. You know, I'll definitely keep an eye on the news as the betas come out and see how it progresses.
Yeah, let's just keep our fingers crossed. It could mm-hmm. be great.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very hopeful.
But they're definitely thinking about it from a security standpoint, you know, first and foremost, which is very good of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I certainly would prefer that. It has to be useful.
Exactly.
You know, it has to actually function would be nice. So are you ready to switch gears and talk about Swift?
Oh, yes.
So give people the top down.
So this one totally floored pretty much everybody. You know, all of the developers that I talked to was like, they were like, you know, Keanu Reeves in Matrix, you know, whoa. So let me set the stage here. Objective-C is a language that's based on C. It's sort of a superset of C that adds, you know, various things like object-oriented programming and other propeller head features like that. Anyways, it's been the de facto language to write apps in since back in the Next days. You know, OS X was bought from Next, basically. And as such, it carries with it a lot of baggage, you know, a lot of the way the language itself is structured. You know, it's harkens back to, you know, ye olde C language, you know, which was made back in the 70s. It's very powerful, but it also gives you the tools that makes it easy to shoot yourself in the foot if you're not careful.
Answer me one question here. Was Objective-C created by Apple or through Next?
It was. I don't know if it was created by Next or if it was created by someone and bought by Next. But
okay, it isn't. Objective-C doesn't exist anywhere else. It's not something you would use to develop for Windows, for example.
No, they do have it. They made it's now a part of the ISO standard. So it is a standard language.
Okay.
And so, you know, you can actually write Objective-C programs for Linux or whatever. You know, there's actually the GNU C compiler has an Objective-C module so you can use it for Windows or Linux or whatever.
Okay. So what does Swift bring? Swift is the new programming language. Nobody saw this coming. I mean, there was not a sniff of a rumor on this.
Yeah, and the thing that amazes me about that is we've now learned that they've been developing this thing for years, and you know, it's just like the iPhone. It's like, yeah, the iPhone's been developed for years, and even the iPhone, there were some rumors about it, but with Swift, nobody saw this one coming. It totally floored us. So why is it cool? How is it better, more secure? You know, the problem with Objective-C and the compiler does try and warn you if you're doing something not kosher, but in general, it follows trust the programmer. They probably know what they're doing rule, which, like I said, ends up coming to bite you in the behind if you're not careful.
But what about Objective-C made it more error-prone than C or C++?
Let me talk about Swift, because as I go, I'll sort of compare and contrast. So why is Swift cooler, more secure, better, etc.? And basically, it mitigates or eliminates a lot of ways in which you can write code that behaves incorrectly, which could conceivably, you know, possibly lead to crashes or worse, security vulnerabilities. So there's several examples of this. I haven't really had a chance to completely dive into it. There's a 500 page Swift programming language book.
You haven't read it all yet?
I have not read it all yet. Like I said, I just got back into town last night. first example is type safety. Basically, when you create a variable in your program, Swift strictly enforces the type. You know, you have to say this is an integer or this is a string, or even in terms of integers, you know, this is a 32-bit integer or a 64-bit integer. This brings both safety and optimization. In Objective-C, it has this really powerful thing called the ID type, which basically means it can be anything, you know, and the way that, you know, let's say you wanted to process a lot of data of various types. You could say, you know, this my function accepts input of type ID, which means you can give me anything. In that function, you have to be careful to check, you know, is this a string that the user gave me? Is this an integer that that got handed to me, and you know, process accordingly. But if you're not careful about that, you know, you can end up doing some pretty not cool things.
Okay.
And also, all of this all of this type checking that Objective-C has to do in the background, it really slows things down.
Oh, okay.
So in Swift, you know, because it knows what kind of variable that you're dealing with, it can optimize. You know, if you know when you know what you're dealing with, you can really optimize things. So
write things a lot tighter.
Yeah, write things a lot tighter. They showed some pretty impressive bar graph benchmarks during the keynote, and I'm just looking forward to trying some code out myself.
Yeah. So I've heard a lot of people saying that there's no curly brackets in Swift, and I remember curly brackets being a big part of that go to fail bug because there, curly bracket wasn't there.
There are curly brackets in Swift, and in fact, they are required.
But does that mean you wouldn't have had the go-to-fail bug?
Exactly. You know, I have a link there in the show notes of the go-to-fail. So if you look at the go-to-fail bug, you say, if blah, 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 then go-to-fail. And if something, some other blah, 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 then go-to-fail. But you see, famously, in that second if statement, the go to fail line is duplicated.
Right.
Well, I think when you and Bart were talking about this, Bart pointed out, well, yeah, it's indented in that code. So your brain thinks that, okay, those two go to fail lines are part of the second if block, but they're not because.
Because it was never closed off with the curly bracket.
Exactly.
So if this. Go to fail, but it doesn't. So it just immediately goes to fail.
Goes to the next go to fail. Exactly.
And that's what caused everything to go to fail, which was the inverse of what it sounds like. It actually caused everything to pass through.
Exactly.
So if it were in Objective-C or if it were in Swift, what would have been different about that?
Would have been different about that. It would have said, hey, you didn't use curly braces in this if statement. Error, error, error. You know, so it would
It's just a better debugger?
No, it's a better compiler. It actually forces you to, put in your curly braces, so then, you can't have the thing where, like in the go to fail bug, where in the go to fail bug, if it were written in Swift, all of the if statements would be surrounded by curly braces. So, in the
you're
second
it automatically
one,
automatically would have been.
Well, no, it would force you to do so. It'd say, hey, you didn't put curly braces in there.
Okay.
Fix it.
Just
try again.
Better debugger.
A better compiler.
Compiler.
Yeah.
I don't actually know what the difference between those two is, so that's why I keep saying it wrong. But that's okay. You don't have to teach me here.
So another cool thing is there's another statement called a switch statement, which is basically a way to condense down a lot of if thens. So you can say you can say switch on a certain variable, and then you can say, if it's this value, do this. If it's this other value, do that. It's basically a fancier way of writing a bunch of if-then statements.
Okay.
Anyways, so with switch statements in Objective-C, you can say, if it's this, if it's do this, then if it's that, do that. But and there is a provisions for a default case. If none of the things matches, then do something else. But it's not a requirement. Up against a case where none of the choices match up, and if the programmer forgot to put in a default case, to catch the those values that those oddball values, that could cause unexpected results in your program. With the switch statement in Swift, it actually requires you to put in a default case. So, it actually makes you think about, what if none of the cases that I present are true? What do I do then?
And so, if you don't give it that, it comes back and errors out.
Right, exactly.
Okay. So it's more written towards what are mistakes people make.
Yeah, it really
hard though to try to catch every dumb mistake we might make as programmers.
Unfortunately,
it's a big job.
It is a big job, which is probably why they've spent years just developing this. And another way that it saves you is it explicitly disallows overflow. So we're going to get a little propeller, even more propeller head here. You know, there's 32-bit integers, and you know, 8-bit, 20, you know, 8-bit, 16-bit, 8-bit integers can go up to 256. 16-bit integers can go up to 65,535, and so on. Well, if you're working with smaller integers, you know, let's say you have an 8-bit integer that's 255. Well, if you attempt to add 10 to that, then you go above and beyond what an 8-bit integer can store. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so then, you know, let's say you were, you know, then that could cause, you know, buffer overflows or other, you know, undesired behavior. Well, Swift
those are bad because somebody can hack your code book.
Yeah. Yeah. So the way Swift, you know, Swift basically says, you know, you can't, it'll detect that and say, hey, you can't do this. And so it makes you think about, you know, well, let's say if I'm trying to add two 8-bit integers together, maybe I need to take that result and stuff it into a 16-bit integer. You know, it's kind of, you know, it's very much inside baseball, but it's a problem that commonly occurs that can really bite you. And Swift,
and that can cause pretty catastrophic effects because of the hackers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good one.
Finally, there's a thing called optional values, where you know, Objective-C, well, any language, almost any language, actually doesn't really have a concept of this thing has no value. you know, let's say I'm writing a function that, you know, let's say I'm writing a function that processes some data, and it returns
no answer for that.
It returns something, but if the processing fails, you know, how do I return from that? Well, basically a programmer has to come up with a convention, like, okay, if this function fails, return a -1, you know, or if this other function fails, return 0. But it's all very arbitrary. And if you're not careful, you know, you might not, if you don't read, like, let's say you're using a function that returns -1, but you didn't read the documentation, so you don't know that -1 is a special value that actually means this thing failed. Well, your code could just kind of blithely go on with this bogus -1 value, and eventually, you know, something bad happens. Well, in Swift, there's actually a way that you can say this, you know, value has, this is nothing. This has no value. And so it's like, you know, back in the old days, you know, there was actually no number 0, which actually turned out to be very important. You know, that's one of the things that the Arabic numerals gave us. Well, this is kind of a similar concept. And, you know, this way, you know, there is a canonical way of returning, you know, nothingness.
Cool.
kind of a funny concept, but it's a really important one.
So once you have the concept of nothingness, then you don't have to give it an arbitrary value that has no meaning.
Exactly.
You simply give it no value, and then it's known that means nothing.
Exactly.
Okay.
And if, you know, if,
by the way, because that was a little nerdy.
Yeah, it is very nerdy. But, and that way, you know, if your program gets this nothing value and tries to do something with it, the compiler will say, no, sorry, you can't do that.
Okay.
Finally, this last one isn't specifically about, you know, security related, but it is really cool. And it's a concept called REPL, otherwise known as read, eval, print, loop. Traditional languages like Objective-C and C are compiled. You know, you have to write the program, run it through the compiler, you know, it either comes back at you with errors, or it says no errors and gives you a completed program. That whole, you know, write, compile, debug cycle is kind of a pain. But when you have a scripting language, like, you know, when you run Python, you actually get into sort of a shell of sorts, where you can actually type in little Python programs and experiment with them right there, you know, on the spot. And Swift has a similar concept. When you can create what's called a Swift playground, and this was demoed in the keynote. I really suggest you go look through this. This is pretty awesome, where it's actually a space in Xcode where you can type in code and get instantaneous feedback as to how the output of that code is affected when you make, you know, certain changes. they went so far as they actually created a little game in during their demo.
Right, I saw that.
And, you know, it's like, if I change this variable, you know, how does it affect the gameplay? This is really, really awesome. And I can easily see this as being great for, you know, education. You know,
sure, actually, if you were supposed to put a negative one in and you put a positive one and all of a sudden the balloon and then flies off the screen instead of staying
can,
there, you go.
And you, and you can instantly see that. And it's sort of like, you know, spreadsheets. You know, you can, you know, if you have a spreadsheet that does a whole bunch of calculations, you can change a particular value and instantly see how that change affects the rest of the spreadsheet.
So this isn't across the entire, like every single time you type anything, it's doing that. You actually go into the playground to play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's really fun. And, you know, like I said, I can easily see this as being used in like education and whatnot.
Now, Swift hasn't been fully defined yet, right? It's calling a beta version of Xcode.
It's still a work in progress. Obviously they've been working on this for many years, so it's probably pretty much, you know, finalized. But of course, as the betas come out, the Xcode betas come out, and developers give their feedback, you know, there might be some changes. But
so you probably shouldn't start your production work in that yet.
At least not until, you know, or at least if you do work on it, be prepared for things to need to go back and fix things. You know, they did say, you know, when Xcode 6 and Yosemite and iOS 8 officially come out, you can start submitting Swift apps to the app stores on day one. So
that's fast.
Yeah.
I did hear again on, you might get more out of the debug podcast than I do.
Yeah, I'm behind in my podcasts. I haven't,
you might want to go check it out, but they had a guy, they were talking about the guy that wrote Swift. He said he is the only person who's been using it for 4 years. So there was a full year that he was writing Swift that he was the only one that knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's nuts.
Cool. That's wild.
That's pretty cool. Well, Anyways, we're about out of time. Any closing comments on this?
Yeah. You know, about Swift, they like I said before, they put out I think it's like at least 500 page reference ebook on the iBook store. It just describes the language in pretty good detail. It's not really meant for beginners, but if you know even a little bit about computer programming, you know, even the concepts in any language, it really makes for a fascinating read, and it's free, so check it out.
You think I'd actually be able to understand it?
I think so. And
I
of
like
course,
people who think I'm smarter than I am.
And of course, you know, there's tons of coverage about all the WWDC announcements, you know, insert name of Apple website or insert name of Apple podcast.
All right. Well, if you guys want to see, have text to refer back to the things that Donald talked about, he did write up terrific show notes, paragraphs and paragraphs of awesome information here, as always. And so why don't you plug your show and tell people how they can find you, Donald?
All right. Well, I do the Otakuno podcast thing. So if you're at all curious about Japanese anime, manga, comics, culture, food, travel, do check us out. It's at otakunopodcast.com. And of course, I also do this app thing as a side hobby, but it's fun. You can check out all of my apps at donaldburr.com/apps. And I am soon to be releasing the next version of the awesome Nasillacast app. In fact, yay! I'm going to send out a new beta this afternoon.
All right. Well, we're holding our breath since this is the iOS 7 version, Donald. iOS 8's on your heels.
I've started working on it in the new Xcode. So,
oh my gosh.
I just want to make sure that it's ready for iOS 8.
All right, Donald. Well, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed and getting geeky on with us.
Yeah, it's fun stuff. Fun times ahead.
All right, talk to you soon.
All right, see ya.
Well, I hope that was geeky and nerdy enough for us. We're going to wind things up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, Blue Mango Learning at bluemangolearning.com, makers of Clarify. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. I got a bunch of good emails this week. And, of course, Tammy with her questions about my top favorite apps. Anyway, you can email me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter and app.net at Podfeet. And do check out the NoSillaCast Google Plus community over there. Lots of fun going on, have lots of discussions, duking it out, having a good time. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla castaways. Even like Dorothy, who came in on her iPad while she's off on her boat. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.